Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Little Woods by A.G. Mock, narrated by Joe Hempel. A personal note from A.G. Mock. The little woods you are about to enter are real. The nearby wooded enclave called the Beechnut is also real, as is the small, idyllic neighborhood nestled innocently at their beckoning edge. I find it worth sharing that nearly all who spent their childhood here have not only moved away, but moved very far away. Cast like grains of salt across the earth, the places where most of my friends now call home are invariably thousands of miles from the little woods. For me, I couldn't seem to get far enough away. In my own exodus, I chose to traverse an entire ocean to live and work in the United Kingdom. Amazingly, I later came to learn that one of my closest friends from the neighborhood had made precisely the same migration. So, the names of the wooded enclaves and mystical childhood landmarks in this story will likely have eroded from use in the real world, as the very few who had ascribed them have long ago drifted far, far away. The result is that only a very small handful of people today actually know about the little woods you are about to enter, as well as its real location. For those individuals, the memory of that dark and pervasive wood will undoubtedly elicit a convoluted mix of intense emotions, from affectionate sentiment to gut-wrenching anxiety. I am one of them. After reading this book, I hope you will be too. While the following story is fully a work of fiction, some of the incidents portrayed within are inspired by events which actually took place, in some form or other in or around 1977. I will leave it to you to decide which. This novel and the two that follow in the New Apocrypha trilogy are therefore born from a troubling and lifelong lack of understanding as to why so many tragedies befell what, by outward appearances, seemed a genuinely paradisiacal place to grow up. From chronic, debilitating illness to premature deaths, alleged arson to suicide, our tightly knit community experienced an onslaught of tragedies far exceeding statistical probability for a neighborhood of such minuscule size. So, if you were to ask me if evil actually exists, a nebulous, invisible, but ubiquitous force able to exert influence upon and change forever the lives of those who encounter it, I ask you, new friend, to read on. Perhaps the story about to unfold will resound in your soul as deeply as it does mine. If I've done my job well, the next time you go for a trek in the woods, you might just hesitate, if only for the briefest moment, as your soul conjures an echo of our time together in the pages that follow. And please remember, any resemblance to persons living or dead is a matter of coincidence, as all characters and events portrayed herein are of my own tortured imagination. They are not mere aliases fabricated to protect the innocent or the others. So now it's time. Come with me, and we'll head into the darkness together. After all, you're not afraid to come play in the woods, are you? Spookily yours, A.G. Mock. It's indescribable how darkness brings on the feelings which come in the night, how everything changes and becomes more ominous somehow. Normality takes on a different guise as we hide beneath the covers, to protect ourselves from the things out there. Prologue, the beginning. Deep, deep within the primeval woods the boys would one day call the Little Woods, beyond the warm yellow glow of summer's evening and the color of the wildflowers, a presence cast its shadow across the darkness which already lived there. It moved through this sanctum of silence and artificial night as nothing did besides, into the bleakest depths where the air pulls crisp and cold at the lungs and the lichen and moss prosper. As it moved, it grew, enveloping the forest in gloom as the scant rogue flowers there fell before its path, laying in withered remains like funereal displays of the poor. Around this presence came a wind. Brushing the leaves on the trees, it compelled their branches into enchanting, ever-increasing motion. With this dance came a sound, like the eerie, distant whispering of countless discordant flutes. As the presence seized its new realm, this whistling of the trees grew, and from it, through it, the presence seemed to speak. This, in the swaying of the trees, is where I shall be. This is where I shall wait. The declaration rumbled like thunder, undulating in echoes across the wood's canopy and becoming stronger as it dared to move beyond, high into the dusk sky. Could it have been heard, it would have been dismissed as imagination. When it was heard, it was. This is where I shall feed. This presence was evil. It was looking for a home. 1995. In the noise of voices speaking half conversations into a dozen telephones and myriad papers rustling in frenzied hands, Ian sat at his desk staring vacantly at the boxy blue-gray screen of his computer monitor. The cursor blinked back at him with equal vacuity. He let out a long, calculated breath and rocked his chair onto its rear legs, scratching at the left side of his head and unconsciously running his finger along an indistinct scar there, just above his temple at the edge of his thick mat of hair. Waiting on the Parker account was really pissing him off now. He'd spent endless days, and more nights of his spare time than he wished to consider, strategizing the precisely perfect print marketing campaign for the fast-rising Parker Realty Group. With new offices popping up across the various boroughs of the city almost faster than one could keep track, Parker had the potential to become a major advertising account for the Manhattan Bulletin. As the newspaper's VP of sales, Ian was sure his investment of time and, yes, even emotional buy-in was about to pay off. Sometimes you can just feel it. He was also counting on landing the account for his team to meet revenue budget this quarter. He wanted them to get their bonuses, and right now this was the only way he could see that happening. But then came the fax transmission from Aaron Parker himself, the group's namesake. It simply read, "May look to the times after all. Maybe try next year. AP." Most people would say Ian was reasonably easygoing, but that single-line fax had him about ready to pitch a fit. Hours and hours of effort lost. More in-person meetings, lunches, and drinks than he cared to consider. Oh, and don't forget the ingratiating ass-kissing. There had been plenty of that. Now, with a meager one-line fax, Ian's budget was out the window. Just like that. Fuck. He closed his eyes, hard, and could feel the blood coursing unnaturally through his eyelids. It was a threatening sensation he'd had before and was aware of the significance of it. Okay, kid. Breathe. Find your happy place, man. He'd committed long ago that he wouldn't take his job, or anything much for that matter, too seriously. No way he wanted to end up like his father. Year after year, Ian had watched him bring all the stress and burden home with him. Every night, chasing the money so hard and taking his work so deeply to heart that one day that heart had nearly decided that enough was enough. But the whole Parker thing was pushing him too far. He slammed his mug on his desk and the remnant sludge of cold black coffee splashed up, out, and over his keyboard. God damn it! Brilliant, Cockerton. Nice job. Sticky rivulets ran down between the keys before he could grab something to wipe it off. So instead, he sat there and simply watched. Time to rethink strategy. He grunted and swiveled his chair a 180. Hey, Felipe, let's grab a cool one, down the major league. Felipe gestured for Ian to keep his voice down as he pressed his ear tighter to the dirty receiver of his tan-colored desk phone. He was unconsciously wrapping its spiraled cord between his fingers as he listened intently to the other end, intermittently peppering monosyllabic comments into a conversation only he could hear. Yeah? Yeah, well, he answered in spurts. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Bye. Felipe Menendez held the receiver at arm's length, stared at it for a single, judicious moment, then slammed it into its cradle, hard, grimacing as he bit his lip. At least I'm not the only one having a shitty morning, Ian thought. Then immediately felt bad about thinking it, then laughed out loud anyway. Menendez shook his head, rolled his eyes, and sort of laughed along with him. But his was a pitchy, nervous sound like that of a child in trouble. I hope the old man hung up before I slammed the phone down. Jeremy Jones, a.k.a. The Old Man, was the paper's CEO and president, responsible for both the bulletin's editorial content and overall revenue stream. Jones oversaw the journalists, the ad sales reps, accounting, photography, and design. All of it. The whole kit and caboodle, as they say. Not nearly as ancient as the nickname would suggest, the Old Man was a good manager. But like most in this industry, he was tough. No pussyfooting around when it came to telling his senior managers exactly what he was thinking. Ian, as head of the Bulletin's advertising sales operations, often envied Jones's style, wishing he could be so blunt. But alas, the advertising department was different. Ian's team, not his staff nor his employees, but his team, were ultimately an insecure bunch. It just wouldn't do to take the same hard-knock approach. Things had to be handled somewhat more gingerly to get the best results from these earnest, hard-working, but somewhat fragile egos who all had something to prove. And also a little something to make them each, well, convoluted, for want of a better word. "You play to your crowd," Ian thought and smiled inwardly, amusing himself over sudden images of some of their various quirks. "I think I heard a click," he replied to Menendez as he came back to the moment, but shrugged as he said it and raised his pitch at the end, just enough to impart that perfectly subtle element of doubt. So it was actually delivered more like, "I think I heard a click." And by the time those six words made their way to his vulnerable ears, Felipe had mutated their conveyance to, "I didn't hear him hang up yet, so yes, you slammed the phone down on your hard-ass boss, and now you're toast and your career is in ruins, so you might as well pack your bags." Amazing how the slightest change of pitch or tone could indelibly alter the meaning of a few simple words. Of course, Ian did hear the click as Jones had hung up on the other end. He'd heard it loud and clear, in fact. But he wasn't about to tell Menendez that. This was too easy and straight-up fun.
"Oh, shit. You're shitting me, right, Cockerton?"
Ian shrugged noncommittally. Menendez bit his lip.
"Oh, son of a—"
He cracked his number two pencil into the same number of pieces and threw them across the room where they narrowly missed a part-time receptionist named Sally, who scowled madly, if a little too overly dramatic. Felipe snarled whimsically back and both smirked. "So, what do you say?" Ian coaxed. "Forget about it? Over a quick beer. In the Yankees-Pittsburgh game." Menendez poured over the work lying on his desk. Papers galore were scattered among pens, cigarette stubs, expense vouchers, and Lord knows what else. His PC barely squinted out from between manila envelopes, folders, memos.
"I don't know, man. Jones wasn't very happy about that report I submitted on the Hoskins case."
Ian leaned back in his chair, clasped his hands behind his head, and became statuesque still. He stared at his friend and said nothing. Menendez plopped down in his swivel chair and rustled through some of the clutter on his desk. When he looked up and recognized the cue, he swiveled to face Ian, folded his hands in front of him, and stared back just as blankly, silent and motionless. Game on. A solid minute passed. Maybe another. Perhaps an eternity of minutes. It was a stupid thing they did, just staring dumbly at each other. No movement, no eye blinks, no twitches. Statues in a moment. Sometimes a colleague would inadvertently stumble into this connected nothingness and, upon receiving no acknowledgement from either colleague, move on with a headshake and a mutter, usually about how unprofessional it was. Sophomoric, downright ridiculous. Then abruptly, as though the freeze had never occurred,
"You're right," Menendez blurted out.
His voice was as loud as the silence had been deafening just moments before.
"Balls to it. I'll take another look at the Hoskins case when I get back. Let's go."
2. The Major League was a sports bar around the corner. It wasn't one of those trendy new high-tech sports themed with multi-tiered TV screens everywhere and MTV blaring from every speaker kind of bars that were springing up all over New York these days. The Major League was old school. The real deal. A guy called Tony Lamont ran it. An Italian-American who'd taken over the bar from his father in 64 and hadn't changed much since. A huge expanse of scuffed and dated linoleum bar ran the full length of a single open room, and only two boxy Zenith TVs, one at each end of the bar, played the game of the day.
Unless there were two games of equal interest to Tony, in which case each one played and usually competed audibly for your attention, as Tony had the annoying habit of keeping the volume up on both of them at the same time. It made Ian feel a little schizo. He'd said so to Lamotte once, laughing as he dramatically covered his ears. But Tony told him if he didn't like it, Ian could just go drink somewhere else. It wasn't said aggressively, just sort of matter-of-factly. That's how Tony was. He didn't cater to his customers. There were too many for him anyhow, he'd often said. So instead, he let his customers choose him. The games on the Zeniths were therefore the games Tony wanted to watch. If you didn't like it, or asked for something else, well then, I'm afraid that was just your tough luck out. Now, that's not to say Tony Lamont was a hard man or didn't care about the people who paid his living. It was like this. If you decided to give his public house your patronage, then great. If you liked it and wanted to come back again, then better still. And if you really liked it and became a regular, well then, let's just say Tony had no family of his own, and that's what you became. His family. And you were treated accordingly. Which, as we can all attest, is sometimes pleasant. And sometimes not so much. Ian and Felipe were regulars, and when they walked into the bar this lunchtime, they were greeted with a warm and boisterous Italian-accented, "Hello!" Felipe laid his 35mm cannon on the bar. "Hiya, Tone." He held out an open hand, and Lamont was already there with a capped glass bottle of beer, condensation dripping enticingly down its brown glass side. Ian held his hand out, and Tony provided the same to him. Then the bar owner lifted his own bottle, tipping it toward the boys. "Cheers, my friends." "Cheers," Ian and Felipe responded in discordant harmony as they lifted theirs and the three bottles clinked. "Tone, the game on yet?" Ian took a swig. On the TV, a fatherly businessman was holding up a shaver and famously proclaiming that he liked it so much he bought the company. "No, not yet, but soon." Tony stepped out of the way to provide evidence to his statement. On the dusty, flickering screen, a sophisticated blonde was espousing the qualities of her slim cigarette as she inhaled with a look of climactic joy, then sensually wisped the smoke from her plump red lips. Ian puckered his own lips and espoused her qualities. He blew a loud and emphatic kiss toward the TV, and elbowed Felipe so hard he nearly knocked the beer from his friend's hand. "Look at that, will ya? That chick? Man, you get too excited, Cockerton. She's way too false. And too..." Felipe surveyed the bar to make sure none were within earshot. "Too blonde. You can never be too blonde." "I agree with the Felipe," Tony leaned down, propping his elbows on the bar between them as he continued to polish a glass. "She is a too blonde, my friend. That's your trouble, Ian. You go for those phony types. You should find yourself a nice dark Italian girl, one who knows how to cook her mama's pasta. That's what you need." Felipe laughed and voiced his concurrence. "Yeah, yeah, so you always tell me, Tone." "Well, you always ask, my friend. So I tell you, and you need my advice. It will get you far, that I promise you." "That's just the problem," Ian muttered as the barman turned to serve another. "I don't ask." The barman turned around, slowly, placing his hand to his ear. "I didn't hear you, my friend." Ian's eyes were saucers.
Nothing, Tony."
But there it was again, that mischievous pivotal pitch, so his words had actually come out like,
nothing, Tony."
Only this time Ian hadn't intended the betraying rise in his tone. Nope, that was all nerves. He cleared his throat. "Just appreciative of your sage advice, Tone." Lamont considered this glaringly obvious recant for a moment, cocking his head to one side. Ian could virtually see the cogs turning as Lamont considered his next move. Would he be kicked out of the bar today? Banned for a week? For life? You just never knew with Tony Lamont.
"No problem,"
Tony answered, except it actually did sound a lot more like, "No problem," and returned to serving an anonymous customer Ian hadn't seen around the Major League before. But then again, 10 million people in the city, you're bound to bump into a new face or two, even at your local hangout. Ian spun on his stool and squared up to Menendez. Oh yeah, that's one. He thrust his index finger in Menendez's face. Felipe shrugged. Man, you've got 19 more to go before you beat my record, son. For weeks, they'd had a running bet on how many times in a single sitting Tony Lamont would say, no problem, without them unduly prompting him. Felipe was in the lead, and had been for nearly 2 weeks, which meant a free beer for me in every visit until the record was broken and there was a changing of the guard, as it were. Like the Parker account, this, too, was pissing off Ian in a big kind of way. Still, a whole game to go, my friend. For some reason, Ian acted out a lame impression of Groucho Marx flicking his cigar. Felipe was confused, but didn't like to ask, so he simply laughed instead. Not really with Ian, but at him. Sometimes Felipe thought that was just the best way. The roar of the crowd crackled weakly from the two Zeniths' crusty speakers as some West End musical chick finished the national anthem. Before she'd even completed the word brave, 20,000 people were applauding wildly. Whether this was in response to her performance or anticipation of the game, Ian couldn't decide. It was more exciting to believe that it was in bated anticipation, so that's what he convinced himself as the Pittsburgh Pirates trotted onto the field at Yankee Stadium. Sweetness, he said aloud, probably without realizing it. You must be joking, Felipe returned, as only a true New York Yankees fan would. Pirates? Those guys couldn't steal milk from their mamas. Never seen a sorrier bunch. His words trailed away as the Yankees threw the first pitch, a low fastball, just below the batter's knee. It was met with a beautifully firm crack of the bat, and the ball rocketed in a crisp, level flight over the pitcher's head. It gained height as it soared over the shortstop, passed above the outfielders, who reached desperately but fruitlessly, then arched and dropped into the stands where a throng of fans scrambled to catch it. After an uncertain moment, one middle-aged man appeared from the melee and held the ball high in the air, met with a low, muttered chorus of disappointment. Home run. Yes! Homer! Ian exclaimed as he beat his hands furiously against the bar. Sweetness! Felipe Menendez's gaze was stone-like. His eyes bore calmly into Ian's face and ripped out his friend's tongue. If only he could. Already? I don't believe it, Tony said disconsolately as he shook his head. Just don't believe it. I know, Menendez said and extended his hands to the bar owner who in turn took them and patted them. Theirs was a remorse that could only be dealt them by the Pirates. The Pittsburgh Pirates, for God's sake. The two bowed their heads in silence while Ian, always one to be sensitive to his friends, that and the fact that he was indeed sitting in a city bar in the heart of Yankees territory, got up from his bar stool, looked around at the variously disappointed New York faces, and, of course, started to dance. And scream, and shout, and laugh. Homer! 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 He chanted, the grin on his face so wide he looked almost insane. He wouldn't have believed it if he hadn't seen it with his own eyes. Lewis, the batter, was rounding the bases and about to take home plate. The stadium, well, perhaps a tenth of it anyway, went wild. Pirates 1, Yankees 0. Did you see that, Menendez? Did you see that? Yeah, Cockerton, I saw it. Then a voice, loud and unfamiliar, bellowed from the shadows at the back of the barroom. Hey, you, pirate boy. The intonation of the voice was flat but deep, and somehow inexplicably malicious. Ian turned to find the source of the voice. A large, burly man in a corner booth sporting a camo jacket and a matted dark beard. The anonymous man Tony had been serving just a moment earlier. Anonymous was silent for a moment. Then he rose from his booth and calmly, but oh so clearly, instructed Ian to shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up right now, pirate boy. Everything and everyone in the bar fell silent, except for the two dusty televisions which, oblivious to the drama about to unfold in a small saloon on 42nd and 3rd, were crackling with a tinny organ melody as a cartoon Yankees pitcher threw a strike across the stadium's jumbotron. then winked to the crowd as the rally text, "Let's go Yankees," spun across the giant screen. It was a disturbingly surreal backdrop to Anonymous pulling out a .38 Magnum from his waistband and aiming it squarely at Ian. Ian's gut loosened as his chest tightened, pulling his body internally in two different directions at once. His lungs constricted, the ribs pressing down upon them. Prickles spread down his spine. Anonymous took a step forward, and the barrel of the revolver was now so close that Ian felt he was staring down the mouth of a cannon. It was unreal. "This is fucking unreal," Ian thought, rebuffing what his eyes were seeing. Except it wasn't.
"Now look, buddy,"
he stuttered, trying hard not to stumble over the words as they forced through his lips on the barest wisps of air. He swallowed, a hard, dry effort.
"Look, I meant no offense."
Anonymous did not move, except the tip of his index finger, which tightened on the trigger. While it may have been imperceptible to everyone else in the bar, to Ian it was a terrifyingly tangible motion. The .38's cylinder softly clicked along its natural clockwise rotation, and the hammer pulled back, locking in the firing position.
"Fucking outsider, bastard scum,"
Anonymous calmly said in an almost soothing, eerie monotone. Then he shouted it at the top of his voice.
"Fucking bastard scum!"
Menendez, hands up and palms out in the accepted gesture of non-confrontation, eased cautiously off his barstool.
"Look, I think we can—"
he calmly began, until Anonymous spun the revolver toward him so swiftly it was astonishing.
"Fuck off, Tex-Mex. You're another one. Fucking bastard outsider scum. Now sit back down. Sit back down right now before I blow your spick ass all the way back to Tijuana where it belongs."
Menendez backed slowly up onto his barstool. Anonymous returned his attention to Ian but did not alter the .38's aim upon Menendez.
"Now, pirate boy, tell me one good reason why I shouldn't blow your friend's cock off."
Without breaking eye contact with Ian, he quite accurately lowered the revolver's barrel just the perfect number of degrees so that it was now aimed squarely at Felipe's crotch. It was a move that reeked of extreme familiarity with aiming this weapon at a human target at close range. Almost muscle memory.
"Tell me!"
"Wait," Ian pleaded. "You've got no argument with him. It's me that's pissed you off. Point that damn thing at me." Anonymous shrugged, his mouth pulling into something like a twisted mimic of a smile.
"How sweet. Sticking up for your faggot boyfriend. But I do have something against him. Against all of you. Fucking faggots. Fucking weirdos. Bringing this country down. The lot of you. Outsider shits and freaks."
His voice had broken to a disturbing crescendo and then flattened just as abruptly as he returned the gun's aim upon Ian. Silence. Except for the baseball game which played on. Something in the recesses of Ian's mind told him the Yankees had just scored a homer of their own, and with the bases loaded. And just like that, the Pirates had lost their advantage. Sitting at the end of the bar on his own, an elderly man began to hyperventilate. His face was dirty and unshaven, hair and clothes ruffled and filthy. What no one knew was that the elderly man had scraped together whatever he could just to pay for that single beer he was about to nurse for the next 3 hours. Equally, what no passerby on the street knew, nearly all who had refused him their pocket change, was that a $2 beer would keep the elderly man out of the searing summer heat and provide, for a few hours anyway, the meekest sense of social belonging. It would allow him to watch a baseball game alongside a handful of fellow human beings, which meant, for at least that period of time, the elderly man wasn't homeless, wasn't an outcast, wasn't a pariah. For the next few hours, the elderly man was just a regular guy, watching a baseball game, and just like everyone else in about every way. Except that he wasn't. Right now, everyone else in the bar was silent, statuesque, except the elderly man. Coming unbalanced atop his barstool, he was clutching alarmingly at his chest as his breath escaped his mouth in shallow, rapid bursts, Shrill, hissing whimpers issued between these as he urgently sucked the air right back in again. It was the excuse Anonymous needed. He spun toward the sound and pulled his index finger. Twice. The first shot exploded.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?